What's up, everyone? Patio Slave Podcast, episode 48. My name is Anthony, and I am here with Nate and Tony. What's going on, fellas? Anything cool happening?
Nah. No, I'm just kidding. Of course, yeah, we're here to nerd. We're doing what we do. This is exciting stuff. We threw out the call on the socials, which check us out on social media, at Patio Slave on Twitter and Instagram, and email us, patioslavepodcast@gmail.com. But yeah, we threw out the call this week for some listener questions, some mailbag questions, right? What are we getting, Nate? We got some mailbag coming at you?
Yeah, all sorts of fans internationally hitting us up with some good nerdy questions that we can kind of deep dive on. So yeah, appreciate all the fandom out there and kind of distract us from the chaos going on in the world, whether it's stonks or just overall chaos. You know, let's just focus on nerdery. You know, let's feel centered in Zen.
You always win when you focus on nerdery.
So this is the second one we've done. We did one, back in August, I think?
Yeah, it was a while ago now.
Here's the thing, little inside baseball. For all our episodes, I mean, we do prep. I mean, a lot of times we don't share what we're going to say on the episode, so it's a cool surprise on the air and whatnot. But we do prep, and obviously when we have interviews, we prep. For this one, you guys curated the content. Listeners did, which is, it's kind of fun. We just kind of react to them, and I know for me, I didn't prep at all for this.
Nah, me either.
Yeah, same. I was on the road all day, so I'm just going to look at these with fresh eyes.
There's some fun ones in here, too. I think, you know, I compiled the list, but I didn't, like, look stuff up or figure out what I wanted to go with. And there's some things I don't have answers to here, but there's definitely some stuff that I get an idea. We'll see what happens. You never know what's going to come out of my mouth.
And yeah, we got a good amount. We got maybe 15, 16 of them, and we're going to try to get to all of them. So we'll keep it moving. Anything you guys want to say before we get into it?
Nah, I think we're good. I'm ready to go.
I'm going to say one thing, just because it's important to beardery. I'm back, baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dry back. January's over, right?
Yeah. January's over. Dry January is great. Feel great. But now I will be a one beer drunk, I guess.
Nice.
One beer buzz. Yeah. One beer buzz. Yeah.
That's good, though. Like, for me, that's...
Jealous of that.
I'm into that.
Cost efficient.
All right. Well, I'll lead off with the first one here, just because this guy's got the same initials as me. T, maybe G, maybe L. I can't remember his last name. On IG asks... Which band created the best music? Blink 182, Boxcar Racer, Plus 44, or Angels and Airwaves?
So all of the Hoppest along and travel. Yeah, I mean that crew, core group, and the ancillary stuff.
Yeah. Yep.
Nate, I want to hear what you got.
This is a great question, actually. TG or TG? I'm gonna go Blink. I really like all these bands, though. In fact, I listened to Boxcar Racer last week, the album, kind of revisited that. Plus 44, I love that Mark kept it going. Angels and Airwaves, obviously the first albums are fantastic. Yeah, I'm going to say Blink, just overall. I think as a cohesive three-piece that made some front-to-back albums, I mean, that one kind of takes the cake for me, I think.
Can I interject real quick?
Yeah.
Let's take Blink out of this.
I was going to say,
because we're all going to say Blink, right?
Yep.
Let's take the stepchildren of Blink 182 and go, Boxcar Racer, Plus 44, Angels and Airwaves. I'm going to add the Transplants, too, because it was in Travis Barker.
Nice.
Transplants.
Yeah.
Let's throw them in there. So let's do those four and try to pick one, because that makes it a little more difficult, and we might all have different answers.
Actually, can I interject? Can we take Transplants off, because no one's going to pick them? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, okay. That's probably true, actually. But I mean, hey, we could talk about it.
All right. So with that framed up, what do you got?
I'm happy you did that because, that does make it a little bit more complicated. I'm going to go... this is really hard.
All right. You think about it, and I'll tell you that I think it's Plus 44, but it's close. I'd probably put that Boxcar Racer album right there, too. They're both really, really good. I didn't get into Angels and Airwaves enough. Now, they've put out more music, and I do like what I've heard, and I think they're pretty close to releasing even new music now, too, right? Didn't Tom put some stuff on the internet today or yesterday?
I'm not sure.
So that's, I think he did. That's exciting. I'll definitely check that out. But for me, I think that Plus 44 record is really, really good, and I'm going to have to put that one number one. So they're number one for me.
So Plus 44, I think, had what, one album? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yep. That one album.
Yeah.
Same thing with Boxcar Racer, and then Angels had a few.
And the Transplants.
And the Transplants. Yeah, I never really got into them as much.
Diamonds and Guns is a cool song. I mean, that's a cool song.
And Yellow Wolf. And Machine Gun Kelly.
Yeah.
There you go.
And whatever else.
I'm going to go... Plus 44 is who I've heard the least of, so it's not them. Boxcar, Small Sample. Probably Boxcar overall. But if you asked me tomorrow, it'd be ABA. So I don't know.
All right, Nate, you had time to think.
Yeah, well, I'm happy you chose Boxcar because that's what I was going to go with. Plus 44, that's what I was going to go with. And because I love that friggin' album, man. What's it called again? When Your Heart Stops
Beating.
Yeah, I listened to that all the friggin' time.
Yep.
So I was going to say that, but I was like really torn because I was like, man, I actually really love that Boxcar album. So,
I mean, it's not that hard. Just pick one, dude. We're not trying to do 10 minutes segment here.
I'm going to go plus 44 as well.
All right, cool. Twan, you haven't listened to that?
I have the album, but I never gave it too much time.
Oh, dude, listen to it. Spin that.
The CD artwork is just almost like bad Photoshop, and the names kind of suck. I don't know. It just and you're sad about
the
blank,
album's good.
You know,
that's true. The album's good. I think you like the album. All right, ready for the next one?
All right, I'll take this one. I'm actually not sure who it's from, but the question is, how many years from a band's conception does it take to produce their best album? So I'm going to take this as literally like the first year, if you went on the band's YouTube, on the band's wiki, like when they started.
Yeah, when they formed.
So, Tone, you start this one.
This is tough because it's probably different for everybody, right? I mean, there are some bands I would say, yeah, I really love them after their first three albums. And I love the back half of their catalog. Probably less frequent for that to happen, but most bands, it's probably in that 3 to 5 year frame. And it's probably that first record. And sometimes it's their second one, but a lot of times it's that first record because that's the stuff they've been kind of honing and working on their whole lives, as they all say. You know, it takes 20 years to write your first record and, what, 1 to 2 to write your second one? So, yeah, probably 4 to 5 years, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, while you're talking, I'm thinking about my favorite bands and their favorite, you know, their top album. Yeah, I would say 3 to 6 years, maybe. 3 to 6. Because where I'm going with this is that covers, in the most part, the first and second album for bands.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The first number that came to my head was actually 3 years. Mm-hmm. So if you incorporate, like you're saying, like demos and like indie releases, and then you're finally on your major release, and maybe that is the first album, and that's 3 to 4 years in. I think it's safe to say like 3 to 4 years is a good, you know, sweet spot. Like, you know that you have it. You've worked together for quite a while at that point. You've worked out any kinks, and you've you know, kind of honed in on the best of your work, like your greatest hits at that point. If you're putting out demos and independent releases, is that major release? So I guess there's a lot of variables to this question. Like, you know, is it the band's major release or is it independent? But how many years from the band's conception does it take to produce their best album? So yeah, I think we're all kind of in the same vein there. It's about 3 to 5 years, 3 to 6.
Great question.
Yeah.
I don't know who that was from. That's the one that I forgot to write the name down. Sorry, guys.
So if you sent that in, great question.
All right, Nate, read us the next one.
Great question. This next question is from Alicia. Great question as well. It's most vivid music memory. Which one of you guys want to take that one?
I think I got one.
Yeah.
It's a concert memory. It's a Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom show. This isn't probably my most vivid, but it's one that kind of came to mind when this question was asked, and I was thinking about it just now, and maybe a little bit earlier today. County Crows at Hampton Beach, geez, I want to say 10 years ago probably, they did this funky traveling circus type tour where they didn't necessarily, like, they played for a little bit, and then somebody else would come out. I think Augustana was on tour with them, would play for a little bit, and then they'd come back out, and then somebody else would play, and they'd just kind of mishmash on stage, which was different. I'd never seen a show like that before. And then during Goodnight Elizabeth, there were fireworks outside, and there was a point at Hampton Beach you could see through, like, the slats in the ceiling, so I could see the fireworks. Well, one of my favorite bands is playing one of my favorite songs by them.
Indoors.
Indoors, yeah. An emotional, awesome song that I just, you know, I have loved for years. And that just, I can still see that moment. I'm just like, damn, I want to go back to that. It's one of my favorite concert moments of all time.
Great memory. And you paint it vividly, so you obviously remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Nate, I got one if you are still thinking.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I have mental images of this show that come into my head at sporadic times, and it's typically when I'm listening to the band. But the year's 2007, the city's New York, the festival's Rock the Bells, and the headliner was Rage Against the Machine. So,
oh, nice.
Why it's so vivid is, like, obviously they go on last. They're my favorite band. I'd never seen them before, and it was close enough to like their last album where it's like, all right, they're together touring. Hey, maybe they'll come back. It's not like through a 2020 lens where it's like, all right, I think that ship sailed. But I remember them going on and it was dark. And Nate, I know you were there, but it was at night. But the lights and stuff made it almost like feel like day, and just the hype of the day. And I don't know. I'm probably not even describing it good, but it just, you know, at that point in time, you know, 22 years in the making. Well, 12 for when I got into them, but 22 for me at the time. It was like, damn, I finally saw it, and it lived up to the hype. That's the other thing. It lived up to the hype. So probably Rage, Randall's Island, Rock the Bells tour.
That's awesome, man. I can honestly say that was a highlight for me as well. And I had seen them before, but there was something special about that night for sure. And it was cool that we were all there together. Man,
that's a show regret for me. I'm not going to lie.
I think we asked you to.
Oh, yeah. Problem. No, I remember. Talk about a vivid show regret. I remember being you guys trying to coax me into doing it. And I don't know. I was broke as a joke at the time, but I really wanted to go. I wish I had. Obviously, looking back at it now, I'm like, man, you should have just gone. Dealt with the money thing later.
I took a Greyhound bus for that.
I probably would have gone with you. I'm an idiot.
Ooh, man. Twan, thanks for buying me some time, because I'm shuffling through many, many vivid, and they're also concert memories. And I'm going to go with the time I finally got to see one of my heroes live was in LA. So being out here in California, seeing David Gilmour, the guitarist and vocalist, or former vocalist for Pink Floyd. And man, I got to say, it was an incredible show. His voice, his guitar work. You know, we talk about virtuoso in here with Eddie Van Halen, like seeing David Gilmour, he's like quintessential for me, you know, like his voice, his sound. Seeing anyone from Pink Floyd is huge in our generation, because we didn't get to see Pink Floyd, unfortunately. They broke up before or when we were in fourth grade. So it just wasn't viable unless we had a cool uncle or something. So, yeah, I got to say that was probably my most vivid music memory, just because I didn't think it would ever be possible. You know, it's like the guy never tours. He doesn't put out a whole lot of music. He's not retired. He just kind of works at his own pace. Unlike Roger Waters, who's also fantastic and tours pretty consistently and does the whole production with the Pink Floyd legacy. David Gilmour kind of does his own thing. He puts solo albums out, which are also fantastic, and then plays, you know, Pink Floyd deep cuts and music that I just adore. I mean, a lot of that music was how I got into music in general is classic rock, and in particular Pink Floyd. So I got to say that show, I had a friend fly out here to see it with me, and we were both just like, holy crap, this is a once in a lifetime experience. And the guy hasn't toured since. So it was very special.
It was a small venue too?
No, it was the Forum in Inglewood,
yeah,
in Los Angeles, which is a legendary arena, which is kind of strange. You know, we talk about venues on here being special, like mostly theaters and clubs, but there actually are some great sounding arenas. And the Forum was designed specifically to have an amazing acoustics. So it's actually world renowned for its sound. Yeah, and that show just, I mean, the lead up to it, my friend coming out to fly to see it, and then us being there to watch it unfold. And we're like, this is incredible. This guy, it's weird this guy doesn't tour more, but it's almost more special because it's such a rare experience. So
I would imagine that the sound too, from just knowing Gilmour a little bit, knowing music, his music a little bit, in that arena would be just dope. Just awesome.
Yeah, it's very like open concept. And yeah, we were just, I mean, he played some songs off his album, which the album was called Rattle This Lock. But he played songs from Pink Floyd that I had been playing nonstop on a Discman or on vinyl for years, just to hear them live from him. Like it was, yeah, that was one of those things where you're, you know, classic face melting moments where I'm like, this is unbelievable. Like talk about tears. Like you're just like, this is incredible. It's like seeing Jimi Hendrix, you know?
I have to give Alicia a little more credit on the Instagram. She said, all right, nerds, what's your most vivid music memory?
Someone's paying attention.
Yeah. All right. We ready for the next one?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. York Dog on Instagram asks, how has Senses Fail still remained so popular with all of their member shifts?
I can start with this one. So Senses Fail, what, they formed early 2000s. They had that first EP. I think it was a re-release on Drive Through from the Depths of Dreams. And they were like, them and Finch were like the heavier bands on Drive Through. They were in that kind of like screamo post-hardcore thing. But yeah, they're still going. And this is a funny question, because within the last week, before this person, before York Dog even asked this question, I found myself on their Wikipedia, and I noticed, and this is going to be my answer to this question, how they remain so popular, is I noticed there's only one remaining original member, and it's Buddy Nielsen, the singer, and I think that's why they've remained
the front man.
He's the reason, because I think the other member that's been there the longest has only been there for like 5 years, and at that point, you know, it's almost like the Patriots, Bill Belichick, the system, you know, he's got a system. Mm-hmm. All the players are interchangeable. And I think that's the system. You got Buddy, the front man. I mean, think about how many albums they've had. They've had, seven or eight albums. So they're playing back catalog stuff. They're obviously playing new stuff, but all that other stuff's been written already. So even if the new stuff is different, there's still that back catalog, and he's the mouthpiece. So he's the reason why. He's why they're so popular. And they are popular. 600,000 monthly Spotify.
Almost seven, spin. Right?
Yeah,
it's almost
crazy.
Yeah, yeah. That has to be it. You're absolutely right. It's the sound. It's not the sound necessarily sonically with instruments, but if the front man or woman stays the same, it's you can always find people to do a reasonable facsimile of what you've done in the past, so you can still continue to kind of chug along with your, you know, your brand, your sound. So. Like that'd be, I think you could do this with a lot of bands, and it's probably happened with a lot of bands. I don't even realize, but where a guitarist is interchanged, or a bassist is new, or a drummer is new, unless they're a, you know, skyrocketing talent, somebody a la Travis Barker playing drums, it's not going to necessarily show up on your radar. But if the front person changes, yeah, that can change things. So it sounds like it's the system, like you said. That's a great analogy. It's Bill Belichick's system, which didn't work this year without Tom right. Brady, which is funny. But I hear what you're saying. It's absolutely right. It worked for a long time because you moved all these pieces around, but those two stayed the same, right?
Yeah, great call. I'm actually in agreement with both your points very much so. The first band that came to mind that's at least a legacy act that's doing the same thing is the band, one of my favorite 80s bands called Foreigner.
Oh, yeah, totally.
They're one original member as well, and you know they tour every year, and they're playing sheds, they're playing amphitheaters, you know, so that's big cash. And it's like between the back catalog and the fact that at least someone in the band original lineup has some kind of control to be able to even do that in the first place is remarkable when you think about it, because it really kind of boils down to that, like how does that play out? Is it equal ownership to all the members? Is it someone that like copyrighted the name in time, like behind everyone's back, like a Sublime kind of thing? So, you know, I trying to put myself in the picture. If I was in a band and I was like, no, man, I want to keep touring. I want to keep playing music. I want to keep writing music, and had that equal share or a way to legally tour and continue the legacy, I would totally do it. So between Senses Fail and Foreigner, which are, you know, polar opposite music genres, it's an interesting thing. And it happens more than you think. I think if people don't realize they're going to a Journey show and realize that there's like two or three members out of the original lineup, they get to hear those songs that are massive songs, but it's not even close to the real band. So
it's funny you bring up Journey, because they went the route of let's find somebody who sounds just like Steve Perry.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. YouTube star. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can continue to do what you do, at least legacy songs, and go out and tour and make your money that way as a band still, when you have a sound alike who can do that. But as far as the new music and staying viable with Senses Fail, that's got to be because they've kept the same mouthpiece from start to finish, or from start to now, not necessarily finish.
Well, the other one other thing that comes to mind is like they came out in 2002. Buddy's our age, so when they started, he was probably 16, 17. So if you get a figure, if you grew up with them, you've kind of followed them all along. And while they've changed their sound a little bit, some albums are more aggressive than the others, it's still pretty approachable. So like pop punk kids like Senses Fail. If you're into more harder stuff, there's some of that there for you. So I think they, you know, kind of straddle that A Day to Remember line, which is overall pretty approachable. So good question. Thank you, York Dog. That was a good question.
Yeah, York Dog hitting us up in the DMs too. Thanks for hitting us up, man. We appreciate it.
So go to the next one here. This is from 3Dog the Corvax on Instagram, who going to shout him out. He's got some cool artwork on his page, and he sent a few things through DM and some cool stuff. He's on IG, 3Dog, 3 the letter, the number, 3Dog.the.Corvax. some cool stuff. Check him out. His question is, what do you think nu metal gave as far as impact, both from musician standpoint and marketing? I like where this is going. Do you see nu metal as good or bad overall in the grand scheme of metal? All right, let's unpack the first question.
Yeah, those are two different questions, but similar, and I like them both.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
So impact from musicianship and standpoint in marketing.
It's tough. I think as we've talked about numerous times on back episodes of this podcast, the money that was kicking around in the music industry around when nu metal was popping off, so there was a lot of marketing behind some of these bands, right?
Like you'd never seen before. Like I mean, granted we were young, but like a lot.
And whether they were good or not, there was marketing
all right,
behind
you're going
these
where I'm going. Okay.
Yeah. Now there were some great bands that came from this too, obviously. And I think those bands we might've seen either way, but we got to see everything because there was a lot of money and they were just, everybody was trying to find another Limp Bizkit, another Linkin Park, another band of that ilk. And there obviously there aren't too many of those kicking around because those guys were, you know, on a different level as far as musicianship went. So we got both and we probably found a few bands that we liked along the way that we may never have found because of it. So that for me is awesome. I think that's the way this worked, was that we had all that money and all that marketing in the ecosystem per se, and we got a little bit extra that maybe we wouldn't have seen had it been 2008.
Yeah, no, I think from a marketing perspective, like there were a lot of people that were duped because of the marketing. Like there were a lot of bands that were jammed down people's throats or were thrown on tours that kind of sucked. And like Tone said, there was some good stuff in that era, but the branding machine was out in full force. Like Limp Bizkit was a lifestyle. Fred Durst, backwards hat lifestyle. Like you had that with Run DMC and Adidas and things. It was Run DMC, Adidas, yep. Like yep. That, those yep. are synonymous. The backwards hat, the red hat, like that was, I mean, the machine was churning heavy in that era. So I can appreciate that. From a musician standpoint, there's some standouts, but I think overall, I don't know, to play that kind of music, I'm not a musician. I wouldn't think you'd need a ton of chops, but there's definitely standouts. And it brought like a DJ element. A lot of nu metal bands had DJs. So there was kind of this hip hop infusion. I think out of those, the marketing was the most like whatever labels, whatever you did, it worked. Great question. Nate, what you got?
Yeah, great question and great points, both of you. I was thinking, like, as I think about nu metal, and pre-show we were talking about the stock exchange, which is kind of funny. Sometimes you buy a stock and, like, you know, 10 years down the line, you're like, that was an obvious stock. Like Amazon, like, that was an obvious stock, right? So nu metal, I think, like, is a culmination of everything that was leading up to nu metal. It was like, well, yeah, actually, nu metal makes sense that it happened because rap was big at one point. Rock was big at one point. Rap, I mean, it's like, rock, metal, goth, like it all kind of got thrown together in one genre. Whether it really is conducive to one genre is a different story, but there was money behind the scenes and it kind of just, it was almost like a shotgun blast, like, hey, this is everything in one, you know, take it or leave it. We're going to put together a family values store and it's Limp Bizkit, it's Korn, it's Ice Cube. It's like, what? This is, oh, but all those genres are nu metal when you think about it, right? So it makes sense and it's a cash grab. And there is a lot of good music that came out of that. And there's also a lot of crap. And there's also a lot of good stuff that came out that people never got really the time of day on, because there's some hidden gems in the nu metal scene that, you know, should have been bigger. And so that's always the case, I feel like. So, you know, what do you think nu metal gave us as far as impact from both musicianship standpoint? I feel like it really is an organic combination of what was happening in the 90s. And we were like the right age. And we're like literally the perfect people to market to. It's like the Abercrombie and Fitch. Like these are people that have their parents' money to blow on this stuff. So let's pump it through TRL and everyone's going to buy it. And we were victims of that, you know, for better or for worse. The good stuff's great and the bad stuff's terrible, but there's a lot of stuff in between that is also good. And, you know, speaking of marketing, we had Frank Maddux on here, right? Some of the best artwork that I can totally just be like, man, if I were to hire someone for my project, I would want his style. And I don't know, I don't want to pigeonhole him into a nu metal style, but his style kind of defined what nu metal is. It's very graffiti-esque. It's spray paint, everything kind of thrown together. It's a lifestyle, like you said, Tuan. And I think for all the good things and bad things we got out of nu metal, I think the good things outshine the bad for sure.
Do we want to answer the second part of that question?
Yeah. Do you see nu metal as good or bad overall in the grand scheme of metal? I would say neutral because it happened. You know what I mean? It was a starting point. It was a starting point for a lot of people, including probably us as far as metal. I mean, we talked about an early episode, like watching Beavis and Butthead and getting into, you know, some heavier bands through that. But like, we were of the perfect age where that was the most accessible metal. So I can thank, you know, I'm trying to think of bands, a lot of gateway bands for me. Yep. through nu metal. So I'm neutral for me. I'm neutral.
I would say it was important for me because I think, like you said, it was a jumping off point into some heavier music that maybe I wouldn't have given the time of day had I not cut my teeth with, you know, Mudvayne, yeah, right. Something like that.
Yep.
So, it had an effect for, I think, us. I think people of our age group, you know, the people who kind of came of age and grew up through the late 90s, early 2000s with this popping off. It made it so that you were comfortable wearing that black t-shirt and maybe listening to something that you wouldn't have given the time of day to if you were 10 years prior. So that I think it was a big deal.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, it's hard to consider it metal. There's metal aspects to it. And additionally, when you think about it, we're 99 into 2000. It was always 70s, 80s, 90s, classic rock. When you get into the 2000s, it always gets a little confusing because 2000s is 2000s. Well, now we're in 2020. So what are we calling it? The 20s, 21. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I almost feel like nu metal was just, they needed to slap something on it. And it has a pretty huge umbrella in terms of what falls under nu metal. So I would say, yeah, it's important mainly because there's so much that falls under that umbrella that's pretty widespread. I mean, you think if Deftones are getting thrown under nu metal, which, you know, they independently say that they're not really nu metal, which I agree with. But if it does on a grand scheme of things, then yeah, nu metal is great because we got Deftones, we got a lot of great music, System of a Down, Korn, and even the stuff that's okay is still pretty good in the grand scheme of things. So I would say that the nu metal scene was something I appreciate.
Yeah, and don't let anyone bullshit you. Like, a lot of the big metal bands now, their influences are those bands. Like,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
it's come full circle, right?
Yeah.
It was huge in the late 90s, early 2000s. 10 years ago, everybody was like, this is the dumbest thing ever. Why did anybody like any of that music?
Yep.
While we continued to ride for Limp Bizkit. And now everybody's like, oh, you know what? It wasn't that bad. We kind of liked a lot of that stuff. And yeah, I might throw on Headpiece Broke today because I want to listen to that stuff again. So it is what it is.
Yeah.
Everything goes in cycles. But yeah, great question. Thank you for throwing that out there. We really love stuff like that. That's a cool question for us.
Tone, it kind of dates us. Just to riff off what you said, it kind of dates us because
yeah,
it's just a matter of like 6 months from now when we go to an Urban Outfitters and there's a Head PE broke fucking ripped up t-shirt that's supposed to look like a Motley Crue t-shirt.
It's almost vintage, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. It is. We're old. That's a good one. All right. The next one is I can't remember who's reading this one. Me? Ooh, Nate. Front to back at one for us, Nate. What do you got?
Front to back. Bands that will call it quits because of the pandemic. Which one do you guys want to go?
I have a kind of a broad stroke for this.
That was going to be mine too, a broad stroke.
I think we're in the same headspace. Like that middling band
there you go.
Maybe they're insurance salesmen on the side, you know what I mean? Like, although if they have a full-time job, maybe they can do it. I mean, we talked to Brendan from Incendiary a couple weeks ago, and Incendiary isn't his full-time job, isn't their full-time job, they're able to come and go as they please from it and continue to put out music, which is badass, by the way. So maybe I'm off, but the band, I guess the people that were working musicians, that was what their main job was, but they hadn't hit that stratosphere type, you know, or even the upper tier of popular situation, then those are the bands that are going to disappear on us, right? Like, that's the bummer.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. I mean, you basically summed up what I was going to say. I think in terms of like the cutoff, like I feel like a Pure Noise Records level band has a big enough following that I'd love to think that any band of that size will hang in there. But it's the band that's like maybe a tier below that, or it's like, you know, they were maybe just scraping by. And I'm not saying those guys are like raking in the dough. I don't know. I have no idea. But you know what I'm saying? I think it's that band right below that they're going to have to really love it because it's going to be tough for a little longer, I think.
This is a hard one to unpack when you think about it, because call it quits because of the pandemic. So, you know, does that mean they're not really touring, obviously? So are they thinking about touring was their main source of income? Because at the end of the day, like if you're continuing to put out music, you know, you can still kind of survive and have a full-time job if you're putting out music online. And obviously we know that, you know, Spotify and streaming services in general don't pay a whole lot, but it's still additional income. Kind of goes back to our Ticketmaster story last week, where if you really want to do it, you can, because it's just it can become a hobby, really. So you don't have to just say, you know what, I don't like my passion anymore because it's not going to allow me to play clubs in the summer because I'm a teacher or something. Well, no, now you can put out music constantly and have that as additional income and almost like an Etsy project or something. Yeah. So I think this question is a little bit more complicated than it looks, but for the most part, I think you guys are spot on that. It's like, it depends on what you considered your music career. You know, is it your full-time job, or is it ancillary to what you're doing 9 to 5? So there probably will be some that fall off, but
I would say that we look at artists like our episode 29 guest, though, Spose, who's put out music throughout the pandemic, you know, bits and pieces here and there, done some cool stuff online, been active. He is in that's his job. It's his main source of income, and hasn't been able to really, he's played one show at a drive-in back in late summer.
Yeah.
He hasn't really been able to tour, which is his bread and butter. I would imagine he does really well with that, selling merch and selling records and stuff that way, and seeing his fans that way. But he's still been able to do it. So it is doable for that level of artist. It's just how many of them want to hustle like that. And that's the one, those are the ones that, like, man, this isn't what I got into it for. I want to play shows. I want to see fans that way. And the music part is awesome. And I'll put music out, but I'm not going to like grind and put a song out a week for 6 months because I'd rather be touring. Those are the bands that we're going to lose, which some of those bands put on great shows. And I want to see them put an album out every 3 years and tour on it.
You made me think of this, that suppose solo artists, much easier to do in a pandemic as opposed to a band who's going to, again, one of these interviews, I'm going to ask the question of when we get a band member on, how often do you practice? I have no idea, but you'd have to get together and practice through your the pandemic. Like, I'm sure that's hard. So great question. Hopefully no one, I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Or hopefully they just pivot and we can get them back as a side project type thing for their everyday job. Like, I'm cool with minimal as long as we get something from some of these bands. I don't want any of them to go away. That's a sad world.
I feel like this relates back to the Census Fail project or band. It's like, well, if one member is, you know, down to continue the legacy, then yeah, they'll reap the benefits. If there's at least one person out of a 6-piece, like, it can continue, you know.
It needs to be the right person, though.
Yeah.
In that situation.
Exactly.
Like, it can't just be random rhythm guitarist who no one knows.
The drummer wants to keep going.
Yeah. Hey, we're Census Fail. No, you're not, dude. But yeah, I hear you. You're right. It could.
But I have sweet bass lines.
Solo artists are, you're right. Solo artists, that becomes a lot easier. You're running stuff by yourself, and then you're going with it. And, you know, for some of them, it works and it's great. So I'm glad that continues to be a thing for them.
That just reminded me of a Family Guy clip where Ringo Starr brings a song to the Beatles. And they're like, oh, that's great. We're going to put it right on the fridge.
Right here on the fridge. All right. Ready for the next one? The next one is a troll, and it's from my brother-in-law. I'm gonna be full disclosure here. My brother-in-law, CR Wendt, asks, quarter pound with cheese or double quarter pound with cheese?
I have a very... I'm very one way versus the other.
You have a staunch stance for this?
I have a staunch stance. So, well, I got a clarifying question. The double QP with cheese, the difference is just it has an extra patty, right?
Yep, that's it.
Way too much meat, especially that shit. The QP with cheese all day. The double, it's like, I mean, it's huge and it's not good, and you're getting two of not good.
All right. I like that. Okay, so let me throw a wrench at you just because. What if the double quarter pound of cheese has bacon, but the regular quarter pound of cheese does not? Which one do you take?
Oh, I take the double because I take the second patty off and you get bacon.
Oh, good. Dude, you're playing chess and I'm playing checkers right now. I think I agree with you. I'm going to have to go quarter pound of cheese for pretty much the same reason. It's too much meat. It's not necessary.
Although if you get the second slice of cheese with the double, I'd take that and then still take the patty off.
All right.
Wow. I'm going to have to disagree, mainly because I'm notorious for being able to eat nonstop. So I haven't had McDonald's, also full disclosure, I haven't had McDonald's in probably over 10 years. So Pink, I don't even remember.
Pink Slime. The Pink Slime got you.
Pink Slime. Yeah. So I'm, you know, luckily I'm out here in Cali. So I have some better choices with, you know, Five Guys. Well, Five Guys is back there too, right? But
I love Five Guys. I don't eat it very often. Maybe once every 4 months. But yeah, Five Guys is great.
But In-N-Out Burger and stuff like that. So I honestly haven't had McDonald's in, oh, I can't remember the last time. But when I did, I would get the double, just because I can eat so much that I can finish a double quarter pounder and still be hungry. I never liked it though.
So you're going double. I'm going single. Tuan's going single.
Yeah,
single.
All right. If you'd asked me this like 15 years ago, I probably would have went double too. But now older and I'm like, man, I can't do that.
Now I want one.
I know, right? Are we going late night?
I think they're two for $5, actually.
Even better.
But he did send an actual question, though, too.
He did, yes. My brother-in-law did send us an actual question. Do you want to read that one? Who's up? Is it you, Juan?
I think it's me, yeah. He asks, CR Went, what are the songs you were surprised to find out were sampled? For example, Eminem's My Name Is sampled, I'm going to butcher this, Labre Cifre. I got the...
I'm going to struggle with this one. And I did not know I never knew who Labre Cifre was. And did not know that Eminem's song was sampled. I would say most of the hip hop we love of the last 20 years. Tuan, we just, one of us just needs to go and the other one can take a walk, I guess. Right? No, I guess a lot of the hip hop, but it does happen in the rock world a little bit where there's some kind of pay homage to somebody else. We talked about it with, The Bicycles of Afghanistan for Crime and Stereo. That sounds exactly like the Movie Life song. 10 seconds. Oh, I'm going to butcher it. What is it? 10 seconds.
Too late.
Too late. And then the Kill Your Idol song, too. It's the same beginning.
Right.
So it does happen at that, too. And I mean, without maybe being credited, but there is some sampling from that. But hip hop is notorious for this, right? I mean, this is just what happened, especially the last 30 years of hip hop, 25 years of hip hop.
Nate, can I go?
Yeah, go ahead.
As soon as I read this, I was like, Puff Daddy's No Way Out. When I was 12, I was like, this is a banger. This album rules. And it still does. But then like 2 years later, you hear the original. And you're like, wait a second. I've heard this before. And the whole thing is samples. So CR Went, I would say that album was the first time I experienced this.
Man, I got to agree with you, Tuan. But also, this is another Rage Against the Machine reference. Renegades of the Funk, when they sampled, I can't remember the name of the band for that, but they sampled the intro and the kind of prelude or middle part of the song for Renegades Funk. I was like, wait, this is a sample, only because every single album prior was all sounds on these albums are made by these four members. And it was like, oh, they actually stepped out of that box. I never thought that would happen, you know? So I was like, okay. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know, because it's kind of it's a covers album. So what do you expect, you know? But I remember seeing that and being like, I just didn't think they would ever do that because they were so proud of being like, no, this is not a DJ. No, this is not a sample. No, this is not a guest musician. This is all these four members that have created this masterpiece album. So I got to say that one. I don't know why I can't think of the band for Renegades of Funk. But yeah, look it up. That was the first time. I think it was 2000. I was like, did they sell out?
2000.
Is that a sellout move? Nah, it's not a sellout move.
Nah, because we did deep dive that album back, five months ago. Yeah. And we did say that they kind of took some of those, because it was the whole album's a covers album. And I think in the moment we were saying that they made those songs rage songs and kind of let everybody else say, oh, sorry, I guess that's yours now. All right, ready for the next one?
I think it's you, Nate.
All right, so next question from Gila, or is it Gila? One of the two. If you could put together a tour, which artist would you want to see perform together? Can include artists of any genre. Wow, this is fantastic. Which one of you guys want to go?
I think you got to go because you asked it.
Oh, well, we'll be here for 20 minutes.
I know that's it's the benefit of me going last.
Oh, man, I've done this before. Okay, I can slap some stuff together, I think. I would love to see Chris Cornell jumping from Soundgarden and Audioslave back and forth. And then maybe tossing a solo song here and there that wasn't terrible. Also touring with Rage Against the Machine, because those guys are there, so you might as well have Zach there too. Also touring with Run the Jewels, you know, because Zach can do some Run the Jewels stuff. And then Killer Mike can go and do some stuff with Outkast. Throw those guys all together. That's a hell of a tour, right? Let's go.
That's awesome.
That's a stadium tour. In 2021, that's a stadium tour.
Yes. Hopefully they do it. Fingers crossed.
I'll go. So I was trying to think of this, like, do I pick bands that aren't bands anymore? Do I pick a year and kind of transport myself back into that space? I don't know. I'm going to be kind of topical with a couple episodes ago. I'd put together like the all Long Island tour. I'd have, and again, you ask me tomorrow and I'll say something else, but Silent Majority, Crime and Stereo, Movie Life, TBS, brand new pre-2010, and yeah, the all Long Island All-Stars. The Long Island All-Stars.
The Long Island Dub Beach Dub All-Stars.
Ooh, you guys set me up perfectly, because I think mine is kind of a hybrid of the two. There was a festival that came out here in California, which I unfortunately didn't go to. I wish I did, called Desert Trip. And it was kind of a tribute to like the, I don't know, 70s, 60s and 70s. It was like Rolling Stones, Roger Waters, Bob Dylan, The Who, Paul McCartney, all these like amazing artists all in one festival. And I was like, damn, that's amazing. Like, and the nickname of it was Old Cella instead of Coachella.
That's awesome.
Which was great. And I didn't go because I'd seen everyone on that tour basically leading up to that tour. So I was like, I don't need to go again, even though it would be great. Had I not, I would have been a fantastic festival to check out. But I remember thinking like, oh, if I were to put this together, I would probably do that same lineup, but I would do like a 90s lineup too for like day two. And that would be like Pearl Jam, Soundgarden before Chris passed away, Alice in Chains with William DeVal, the new singer, Foo Fighters probably in place of Nirvana. And they've done some Nirvana, you know, shows with different singers to kind of fill in for Kurt and stuff like that. And then do like a day three 2000s, you know, I don't know, 2000, 2010 with like Kings of Leon and the Strokes and all these bands, and just continue it like a 4 or 5 day, you know, festival of just like decades. Super nerdy, super nerdery related. But I remember thinking like, man, they set the stage. If they kept this going, they could literally do like an 80s U2, you know, like Dire Straits, like just mega festival and cash grab too. So everyone wins, you know? And for a ticket like that, like nerd, not nerd, people that just want to be there to say they were there kind of thing, like you can charge pretty much anything for that ticket, you know? And the Old Cella ticket, the Desert Trip ticket, I want to say there were $600 a pop, but it was 3 days and it was all that music. So you're still getting kind of a deal, you know, when you think about, and we've talked about Bonnaroo on here, like that's lodging included too. So it pays out, you know? I mean, I saw Paul McCartney, just him, and it was $200 a ticket, so that's, you know, $400 for just one artist. So yeah, that would probably be my dream festival or concert bill.
Nice.
That would be a blow. Okay, so that ticket, what is the cap that you would pay
for the one I just mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's say if it was 5 days,
yeah,
in that kind of like caliber that I was just mentioning, I'd pay probably $1,000.
I was gonna say $1,000 would probably be my cap.
Yeah,
and I'd need to plan.
Well, you got to factor in travel, like. Because I like,
yeah, for us it'd be a little bit more.
Yeah, because you'd factor that in. So all in, including travel, I mean, you probably spend a lot more.
Yeah, it's $2,000.
You'd probably be down to, I mean, because you probably would stay there and sightsee and all that stuff too.
I mean, that's like going to any show though, right? Like you like buy the ticket and you're like, oh, nice, I can't wait to go to the show. And then like leading up to the show, you're like, all right, got to pay for gas. Well, I'm going to be there, so I got to buy food. I'm in the show. Now I'm buying merch. I bought a $15 beer. Probably going to want at least two. Like, you almost pretend like you're not going to drop a shitload of money.
It's impossible. All right, Tone, you are next.
I am. All right, that was a good question. Thank you, Jala. Gila,
great question.
Gila, whatever her name was. This one comes from Setla, the aforementioned in many podcasts person who is pretending is our engineer.
Jamie. It's our Jamie.
He's our Jamie. Yeah, he's looking stuff up for us right now. No, he had a question for us. He said, what album or albums got you through the roller coaster of emotions that was 2020?
Before we do this one, Tone and I are going to have the same answer.
Maybe.
I think we might. We will.
Yeah, we very well could. No, I'm going to throw out there, let's not talk an album from 2020, because we did that. We've talked about our favorites from 2020 and did that whole thing a couple episodes back. So if you want to hear what we listened to from that, go back and listen to, I think, 42. But for this, let's go with something older that didn't come out in 2020 that got us through last year. That's going to throw a wrench in things. Huh?
Yeah, because my answer was going to be Spanish Love Songs.
Yeah,
it just,
great.
It summed up the year. It was like meant to be.
Great record. Yeah, I would agree with you.
So I'm going to pull a Nate here and stall for you guys.
I got you. No, I got one. I listen to a ton of Home Safe. I listen to a ton of Frank Turner stuff from 10 years ago. So for me, jumping back into things that I liked that were familiar, Tape Deck Heart by Frank Turner is a great record. Jimmy Eat World, it doesn't really matter. I could pick a record, put it on, and be happy. So, you know, Surviving, which came out in 2019, I think, right? And or maybe early 2020, but we didn't. No, it was 2019. And then that Home Safe record that came out in 2018, which I just love. So, yeah, those are the ones that got me through last year that weren't from last year that I just really kept coming back to and were good for me, made me happy.
Yeah, for me, 2020 was the year of the Deftones and I think a lot of it was from this podcast. Like we've always said, like they're the house band, we ride the hardest for them. So I listened to more Deftones in 2020 than maybe any other year. Listened to a lot of NFG, Newfound Glory, very positive, nice, upbeat, and a pop punk band, Belmont. I listened to them quite a bit in 2020. What you got, Nate?
I'd like to know the actual metrics on what we were listening to like verify this, you know, for sure.
I just did actually. Through the Spotify.
Oh, you did?
That's why I needed time. Year-end metrics. I looked at my top artists.
That's awesome. Yep. I'm not going to pull that up, but I'm going to go by chance and say, and I think I've mentioned on here a ton, Nine Inch Nails for me was a great way to not escape from what was going on, but have someone else process the difficult times for me. And Trent's a big hero of mine. Obviously, anyone that's been following us knows that I've talked about him and his work and his way of portraying difficult situations through art form many times. And I just feel like all the music that he's put out has just been very conducive to, okay, this sucks, but it's only gonna, it can get better. There's probably the great thing about Nine Inch Nails is it looks like this dark gothic music, but it's actually pretty uplifting. It's don't judge the book by its cover kind of band. So I got to say, first thing that came to mind, you know, it was Nine Inch Nails just because I played a ton of it, all of it, and The Fragile in particular, but all their albums, even the instrumental music, I just kept revisiting. I was like, okay, this guy does it for me. He's helping me get through it. This is, what do we call it? Heavy therapy for me. So,
Which is amazing because those albums, some of them came out 25 years ago. So for those to still kind of hit that mark and scratch that itch when you need it is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
How they hold up.
Yeah, timeless music for sure.
All right, the next one is from P-Luck on Instagram. What's the coolest thing you've learned through Patio Slave interviews this past year? So we've had, I don't know, 15? We've interviewed maybe 15 people over the last year. So what's the coolest thing you've learned through the interviews? Anything jump out?
I'm going to go, I think what really resonated with me throughout the interviews is like a consistent theme was everyone that we've had on kind of laid down the tracks before they got to where they were, which is pretty inspiring for me. And I think probably for all of us and maybe even listeners, that if you really follow your passion and truly believe in what you're doing and don't let anything get in your way, you know, life's pretty obviously difficult considering what's going on today, and just, you know, stay true to it. And it pays dividends. You know, we've had some heroes on here, you know, Greg from Zebrahead, always loved him as a kid listening to his music and to hear his story. Frank Maddox, we talked about him earlier, to just, you know, do what he knows he likes, you know, stands out and look at where he is today. I find that fascinating because it just kind of proves that you don't have to follow any kind of template. You can do your thing, do it for you. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, you know, find ways to pivot, but eventually like you'll find your course. And that's what I've been doing. And I feel like everyone that we've had on has kind of told a story in some kind of different direction. And they've all kind of led to that same destination. So I think that's been really inspiring for me.
Yeah. I'm going to piggyback on that. What's the saying? Luck is the cross section of what is it? Opportunity. And what's the saying there?
Preparation.
Yeah. Preparation. Luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And I'm going to agree with you, Nate, but I'm also going to say that a lot of the themes, a lot of the guests we've had, how they kind of hit it big was almost by chance. You know what I mean? It was either, you know, they benefited from maybe the region they came from. They opened for someone who saw, you know, and someone saw them, or they hit it at a show, you know, they got a showcase and whoever was watching them really liked it. So I think it opened my eyes to say, hey, anything is possible. You know what I mean? As long as you're, you know, maybe good at what you do and you put yourself out there. And that's the thing. You got to put yourself out there. And it's kind of, in a lot of ways, kind of like what we're doing. Like, you know, we don't know who the hell's listening to this for the most part. We're just putting it out there. We're enjoying it. People seem to like it. So, yeah, I would say that's the theme, is passion, luck, opportunity, and just right. Sometimes right place, right time.
And a shitload of hard work.
And a lot of hard work. Exactly. Yep. It's not, I'm not saying it's all luck. You're right. And
there's a ton of hard work.
Combination of all that, but you got to be lucky to break.
So both of you kind of jogged my memory on a couple of stories that we heard over the course of our interviews this past year. One from Ben Collins, the interview we had with Ben Collins of Chronic Future, he giving us the whole rundown of how they played for Jimmy Iovine at the Viper Room, right? And how that was like made for a movie. That whole story was made for a movie. And then we talked to Toby McAllister of Sparks the Rescue, who you would argue both of those bands got to about the same level of fame. Similar, you know, they both hit to a crowd and you know, played internationally and did all that stuff. And he's playing at a bowling alley and somebody found him there. Right. So that it's like, it's completely opposite. Like the dichotomy of how both of those two bands got found out, you know, at the level that they did was nuts to me, and to hear both sides of that. So yeah. And the theme there was they both had been grinding, working hard, playing shows, working on their music, working on their songs, putting out good stuff. And somebody found them somehow. Doesn't matter how, but very similar to what you guys are saying, that hard work and preparation meets the opportunity. So yeah, totally. Those two stories kind of stick out to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, it's always that, like, show you turn down that may have been the break, or the song that you didn't put on the album that, you know, maybe could have, you know, hit with people. It all lends itself to just do it. You know what I mean? Just play the show. You know what I mean? Play the show, respond to the fan, you know, whatever it may be.
You don't know what you're going to get.
Exactly.
You might as well do it. If you don't do it, you're going to get nothing.
You're going to get nothing. Might as well exactly. Do it. So I think you nailed it, Nate. It's hard work.
It's hard work, but I think you also made a good point that it's there is a lot of luck. It's a perfect intersection of luck and hard work. But if you don't put yourself out there, you'll never get it. But if you don't work hard, then you'll never even have the confidence to even get to that point in the first place. So it's really kind of like building blocks. And I think relating it back to this podcast is a great example, because we didn't know what we were doing. You know, we don't know who's listening, but I know that we like what we're doing. In fact, it kind of goes full circle with the whole nerdery thing. So it's like we geek out on all these bands and reading their bios, and it's like, well, yeah, we put this band together because we weren't hearing the music we wanted to hear. Well, that's kind of like this podcast. We weren't hearing what we wanted to hear in terms of music appreciation. So we're like, well, I guess we'll do it. And so it's played out for us. So it's really similar in a lot of ways, I feel like.
All right, we got a couple questions left here. Yeah. Is it me?
I think it's Nate.
Oh, yep. All right, from Matt G. What songs do you listen to when it's Friday and you just want to feel good? This one's more complicated than it sounds.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. You guys want to go?
Okay. So this kind of fits with our Mood Boosters album, right?
Exactly.
We talked about this back, 20 episodes ago, 25 episodes ago. Yeah, good Mood Boosters. The songs you want to hear when you roll the window, you know, it's nice out. You want to roll the window down. You want to crank the stereo. I have a very odd one. And I don't know if I brought this song up back then because it wasn't a full album for me. But this Mood Booster song is not a happy song, but it's Rehab's It Don't Matter. I don't know if I brought that up in the past, but
no, I don't think
it's
so.
It's not a happy song at all, but it reminds me of spring, Maine, April of, 2001. I had my license. I'm driving. This song was big on the radio at the time. And it's like, I'm finally kind of, you know, the first taste of freedom you get when you're 16, 17 years old and you get to drive in, you know, your parents' car, your beater that they save for you to drive around town with your buddies and listen to music. Like, that was the feeling I got from that song. So yeah, when I just want to feel good and it's Friday, I listen to Rehab's It Don't Matter, which is not a very happy song if you listen to the words.
No, that's a good one. For me, yeah, you nailed it. It gets down to the Mood Booster stuff. So growing up, going to shows, you know, 2003 was when the summer of 2003, I went to a lot of Massachusetts shows down to the Palladium, a lot of VFW shows, whatever. And I'd make road trip soundtracks from, I don't know at the time, maybe iTunes had just come. I can't remember what it was, but I'd make road trip mixtapes, and I'd always put, you know, the songs you want to hear when you roll the windows down. So a lot of Newfound Glory, a lot of Saves the Day, a lot of Drive Through Records bands, stuff like that. Reach the Sky is always on there. So a lot of that stuff, a lot of pop punk and adjacent stuff for me.
Yep. I'm happy you guys helped me draw this out a little bit, because there's so many variables to this question. You know, is it music therapy? So you need that heavy, heavy death metal therapy, or is it, I want to chill and just listen to some reggae, you know? I think overall, I can say that consistently, if I really want to feel good, it's something that I'm extremely familiar with. So it's kind of falls in my favorite bands. And one of my top three favorite bands is Pearl Jam, and especially the live bootlegs, because it's a show, it's a concert. So we love music. We love live music. And the Pearl Jam bootlegs are just legendary, because you get so much of the story of what's going on in that snapshot of an album. You know, Eddie's talking about what's going on in that town. He'll even talk in the language if it's like in Italy or France or whatever. So you get that. And it's like, you know, a 3.5 hour show. So you get just this consistent block of time that just helps you chill, escape, enjoy that Friday, whatever it is. And I've been doing that a lot lately, because I was listening to a lot of podcasts and playing a lot of music on Spotify. And this past week, I've been utilizing my SiriusXM and using the Pearl Jam station and even other stations like Fish and Grateful Dead, and just listening to all these live bootlegs. I'm like, man, it's all about the live bootlegs. It doesn't have to be specific to Friday, but if you want to feel good, like, there's nothing better than listening to one of your favorite bands play live, cruising around and being like, you know what? Life's actually pretty damn good, you know?
Well, but the question was specifically Friday.
Specifically Friday, yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'm doing this 5 days a week, so I guess I'm feeling good.
It's Friday every day for you? I love that, bro. I love it. That's a lifestyle right there.
LIVIN, live in.
That's good. No, I think we're all in agreement to some extent on how we handle that. It's Friday. It's, you know, maybe it's 60 degrees out in April, and we're like, yeah, let's roll those windows down and let's party.
It's funny. We all associate the feel good with, like, getting in the car and going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. The Edge asks, so we think we have a couple left here. The Edge asks, what artist or band would you most like to spend a day with to pick their brain or their brains, depending on who it is, and why?
This I got is a one. Big question. All right, good.
I want to talk to, there's two, and I think, Nate, you're going to agree with both of these. Maynard, I would love to just hang out with Maynard, drink some wine that maybe he made, and, like, ask him what, just questions about things. Because, like, that's one of my favorite Joe Rogan interviews, is when he has Maynard on, because they just go, and it's just, there's no, you don't know where the conversation is going to go. It feels like a Tool song. Like, you just don't know where it's going to go, where it's going to start, where it's going to end, how it's going to happen. Yeah, exactly. It's 3 hours and 23 minutes long. And you're like, I'll listen to this in the car over the next 6 days before it's over, but I will listen to it and it'll be good. Or Trent. I think Trent Reznor would be a blast to talk to, because there's just deep nerdery questions I want to ask him about music that I've, you know, come to know and love over the years that he made, and why and how and all that stuff. So, yeah, those two.
For me, I'm going to go probably, you know, my favorite band or top three bands. So Rage Against the Machine. There's so many questions I would ask that, because Zach has chosen to live, you know, out of the limelight, there's not a lot of answers out there. So it's like, all right, why do you guys call it quits? Did you really hate each other? Do you stand by the messages in your songs? How much of it was an act? Why go major? You know, like, that's just right off the dome. Like, I'd love to just, have a few IPAs and be like, dude, bomb track, man. You know, how'd you come up with that riff? Or, you know what I mean? Like,
it started as a sketch in their notebook, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's pretty much it. I would say probably Rage. I'd probably spend most of the time with Zach, just because there's not a lot interview wise and footage of him in the last like 20 years, really. I mean, go on YouTube. There's not a ton. So maybe Zach, if you're listening, episode 49 is coming up, brother.
Yeah, we could use you. We'll clear the schedule.
We could use a guy. Party of Slave could use a guy like you.
Hell yeah. Rage, house band. I got to riff off both of what you were saying. I'm so happy I kind of like draw it out on purpose so I can kind of hear you guys and riff
that
off.
That makes one of us.
I was going to say, that makes one.
Lean into it, bro. It's you. I love it.
All day. Great call, Zach. Actually came to mind too, just because I would love to hang with someone all day and pick their brain from someone that is like somewhat obscure, but also extremely intelligent and, you know, geek out, you know, and it's something similar to what we're doing here, but really spend the day and get to know someone almost like non-agenda, but somewhat agenda, like let's, you know, talk shop, but also hang out. And the way you're explaining De La Roca, I was like, oh man, that would be cool to kind of get on a level and just, you know what, let's just spill the beans. Let's just talk it out. Almost like therapist style, like no, you know, no wire style. Let's just tell me what the fuck happened, man. Like, where the fuck have you been? So I'd have to agree with both of you. The first thing that came to mind was any of the guys in Led Zeppelin for me. One of my favorite bands, definitely top three. And similar, there's a lot of mystique about the band and that era. There's all sorts of stories and rumors, but I feel like nothing's been fully confirmed. I mean, there's a unauthorized biography on Led Zeppelin on, you know, what they went through and how it was like coming up and everything, but nothing from like the horse's mouth in terms of like how it actually went down from Robert Plant, Jimmy, you know, John Paul Jones, Jimmy Page, and John Bonham, even though he passed away. So I would love to just hang out with them and just be like, you know, tell me how it was, because I remember seeing Almost Famous and getting a kind of glimpse on what it was like back then. But to hear it from them verbatim would be fantastic. And it seems like they kind of shy away from that, probably because it was kind of somewhat controversial. So if I had that opportunity, you know, uncensored, you know, just tell me what the hell it was like to tour in the US in 1969 would be kind of cool. It'd be like a really cool, something you could translate to a movie like that one about Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, you know?
I'm shocked that it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. Like, at this point especially, like, what are you hiding from? Maybe not hiding. Hiding's not necessarily the right word, but I'm shocked that hasn't happened yet. This is also a callback to episode 2. They were in my tour time machine.
Oh, yeah.
seeing Zeppelin right as they broke in England was a thing I wanted. Yeah, so you just called back episode 2, Nate.
Hell yeah. Deep nerds think alike. Full circle.
Nerd runs deep.
Oh, it runs so deep. Yeah, that's a great call. And I'm just shocked it hasn't happened yet.
I hope it does, because I'm sure it's a really cool story. Because that band is...
I remember hearing Robert Plant on the Jim Rome show, which is, he's a sports radio guy. He's been around for 30 years. But he had Robert Plant on one day, just randomly. Oh, wow. Yeah, and at the end of the interview, Robert said, Jim, I'd love to talk to you off air at some point. I could tell you some stories that would really get you going. They're like,
oh, wow.
Dude, tell him now. I want to hear him.
I'm listening. I won't be listening later.
Oh, my God. Like, that always stuck with me. Like, man, why hasn't this happened? It should have happened by now.
Shit. It's got to be some stuff that just, like, is too either A, too controversial, or B, like, you just, I mean, they're kind of a private band. You know, maybe they just want to keep it private, which is great, you know. Not everyone wants to be in the limelight, even though they're Led Zeppelin. So
they're Led Zeppelin, exactly. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. All right, we got a couple left. Let's get these done here.
So we got there's three left. We'll do kind of maybe lightning round-ish on these ones. So I think it's me. So this one comes from IG user. It was a good dream. What was the best live show you've ever attended? Ah, man. I think I've said this a million times. I've been to probably 500 shows. Actually, I know I have, because I have a spreadsheet. You
cataloged them all, yeah.
I honestly can't pick
nerd.
One. I think
nerd.
I think the seeing Rage is up there for sure. So I'm going to go with that. I could pull up the list, but I'm not going to.
Mine was U2 in 2005. Which I think we've talked about on this podcast before. But yeah, a religious experience. I was 2 rows from the top of the stadium, and it was still the best concert I've ever been to.
Amazing.
It was nothing. There was nothing like it.
Wow, I think I'm a hybrid of both. I was trying to think of something else, but that U2, I always figured was my best favorite show of all time, because it was pretty moving in a lot of ways. But Rage at the same time was like, seeing it was like something I never thought I would see. And it also, you knew, like, you were seeing something that, like, wasn't going to be around much longer, or you'd be telling your kids like, oh, you saw Rage Against the Machine in their heyday? It's like, yeah, man, it's lucky. And I think both kind of fit.
You say because... yeah, man, to your kids.
Yeah, man.
To your daughter.
I can't wait. I can't wait.
Hang 10. Hang 10, man.
Yeah, you take your car to work, bro. I'll take my board. That's 2 weeks in a row. I'm going to wonder how many times I can do that, but that's 2 weeks in a row.
Oh, man. That's awesome. I think I'm going to literally, I hate to piggyback on both of you, but yeah, both those, you two and Rage Against the Machine, are quintessential, one of a kind, can't be repeated in the time artists. And if you got to see them in their heyday, like, you can't top it, you know? So speaking of Led Zeppelin earlier, like, if you got to see them in that heyday, then that would take the cake, but we weren't in that generation. So, yeah.
All right, Nate, you get the next one. I think it's from Mike Archie.
Mike underscore Archie asks, when all is said and done, who will have left a greater legacy on the music world, Dave Grohl or Kurt Cobain? Damn, this is a good question.
I got thoughts.
I do too.
Yeah?
Yep. I'll lead off to one?
Yeah. I'm going to say Cobain just because it's like the whole Tupac Biggie thing. Like, you don't know what would have happened. And I think with Grohl, a lot of people... like, don't care that there's a new Foo Fighters album dropping. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, again, like the Rage Against the Machine thing. They had such a short career that's added to the legacy. In terms of greater legacy, you have, you know, three good albums, or, you know, how many albums did Nirvana have? You know, you have three good albums out of four, where Foo Fighters maybe had three good albums out of 10. You know what I mean? That's not scientific math, but you guys get what I'm saying.
Yep.
I think it's Grohl, and I think it's not just because of the Foo Fighters. I think he also was part of Nirvana. And as we've talked about in this podcast in the past, a big reason that why Blink-182 was so popular and went so well was because of Travis Barker. The same could be said for Dave. I mean, his sound was his sound for Nirvana. Not to poo-poo Kurt Cobain, but yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. And then you got Foo Fighters stuff. And there, go listen to Everlong and tell me that isn't fucking amazing. And that's just Dave. That's all Dave. So, and he drummed for probably the second or maybe the best Queens of the Stone Age album, depending on who you ask, Songs for the Deaf. So he's been bopping around all over the place for quite some time with different musicians.
Do you ride for the Probot album?
I do not.
I haven't listened.
Never listened to it.
Yeah, I never really listened.
Maybe we'll put Probot on the playlist this week.
We'll find out, right?
Oh man, this is a really good question.
Tiebreak us, Nate. Let's go. No pressure.
I mean, I actually had my, I was, you know, I had made my decision beforehand, but it's always great to hear both points. I'm going to go Dave Grohl as well. And it's mainly because the question is broad enough to say that it's a greater legacy on the music world overall, right? And what Dave Grohl has done for the music world overall is massive. He's a straight up nerd. I mean, he's got, you know, he's doing projects with other bands.
Yeah.
He's sessioning. He's Queens of the Stone Age, like you said, Nirvana, Foo Fighters, which is huge.
Tom Petty.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
I can see that perspective. I'm not going to change my vote, but putting it that way, I could be swayed.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I think the nerd aspect, he's front and center with the whole nerd thing. Like, he's done... you know, what is it called? Sound Studio?
Yeah, Sound City.
Sound City, right, in LA, and kind of showcased, made a whole documentary on just that studio alone. Stuff that, like, nerds want to hear. And it's like, dude, this guy's a straight-up geek. Mm-hmm. But he's also a fucking rock star. And he flaunts it, you know, in, like, the most flamboyant way, because he's fucking hilarious and super hyper and energetic fucking guy to just... nice, man. I'm happy there's someone out there like you that's speaking for us, because I'm not in the limelight like that to really showcase it. And we're trying to do it on Podiosleaf, but he does it in a way that's like, yeah, I'm the drummer from Nirvana, but I'm also a nerd, and I'm going to put out this documentary on how music sounds a certain way in New Orleans than it does from LA or Chicago, you know, and put it on HBO for the hell of it. And I think that that's a nerd strain that he has, that, you know, he doesn't have to do it. And the fact that he's doing it is strictly out of the fact that he is also a fan. And really brings it home that, like, every time you hear, like, yeah, man, they're just one of you, all these rock idols or whatever, they're just like you. Like, Grohl's like undeniable. Like he really showcases that. And so I think overall, to kind of end it on a high note, is he brings it full circle because he is actually doing it where everyone else could do it, but they're not. And he's like, any downtime from the Foo Fighters, he's actually putting these projects together, and it's strictly out of passion. So,
and he's also proof that you can do it all if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
from an instrument perspective, and you know, the documentary, the live show, you know, the studio stuff, all that. Yep.
Elbow grease. All right, last one. CD on Instagram asks, what band or artist made you fall in love with music? And I think there's a second part of that, but while you guys are thinking, I'm going to look it up. Because I think there's an F-bomb or two in there. from CD on Instagram says...
Drum roll.
What band or artist made you fall in love with music and were like, I fucking love this band?
I'm happy we paused for that because that actually changes the whole dynamic.
So just, I guess, to frame it, are we saying the first artist where you felt that,
it's probably
the first
early
time.
On.
Yep,
I think the first artist, I've got one if you guys are.
Yep, go for it.
I think the first artist for me that I did a deep dive on, like really sunk my teeth into their back catalog because they had been around for 25 years at that point, 30 years at that point, was Led Zeppelin. So to kind of piggyback on what Nate said a little earlier tonight, they were, when we were 17 or 18 or 19, a band that we would just find and listen to no matter what we were doing, whether it be WBLM, which is a rock radio, classic rock radio station in Portland, Maine, been around for 40 years. Every Tuesday night or every night at 10 o'clock, we'll play something called the Zep Set. And Tuesdays they play Two for Tuesday. So we get four songs and we were like, this is awesome. Let's find a radio and listen to the Zep Set. Going to Bull Moose and buying the CDs whenever I can get my hands on them. Now having most of them on vinyl, older pressings, not newer ones, just so that I could like listen to what the old ones sound like with a little crackle and feel that warmth and all that stuff. So yeah, Zeppelin for me to start. There's been plenty since, but that's the band that I like really sunk my teeth into and said, I'm going to spend some time with these guys and make sure that I know everything.
That's a great one. So that was what, late teens?
Yeah. Yep.
For me, I guess just getting back to like the literal question, what band or artist made you fall in love with music? So this was the first artist that I did was Rage Against the Machine. So I was 11. It was fifth grade. Spring of fifth grade, believe it or not. A kid in my class, because we went to, for the listeners, we went to different elementary schools across the city, but a buddy of mine had an older sister who was into Marilyn Manson, Rage Against the Machine, and he had the Evil Empire tape in the spring of 96. And I remember hearing it and being like, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know anything about this. I love it. I'm all in on it. And I remember getting, going to the main mall and getting the tape of it. And I still have the tape, but that was, for me, it was when it all started. Cause then you kind of grew up with them and then you get into like Zach's old bands and you're like, you get into this other culture of punk and hardcore and whatnot. And I still throw on that album once a month easily. And I have it on vinyl too, for the original pressing from early on. So Rage.
Hang on to that bad boy.
Yeah. Still
nice.
Got it.
Wow. Rage. House band.
I've said them 10 times this episode.
I know. Okay. Hey, it's foundation, right? At the end of the day, you know, we try to shy away from like the foundation, but at the end of the day, like it is what it is. Like for me, I was trying to shy away from this, but if it's what comes first thought, then obviously that's the one. So for me, again, regurgitating from what I said earlier, Pearl Jam, I found them pretty young. I think I discovered them on Versus, so didn't really catch them on 10 and revisited that and then went forward after that. But I was young enough to be like, I really like everything. This music is speaking to me, and trying to find your identity as a music fan or even just as an individual in general, you know, everyone's kind of trying to find their niche. This is like early 90s. So we're like, it really was, we talked about this with Brendan from Itinerary, like, you're trying to find your thing, like what represents yourself as a person. And Pearl Jam was like, nice. I really like this music, and this is going to be my music. This is going to be what I identify with. and my brother was Smashing Pumpkins, and some people were Green Day, and I was like, nope, I'm Pearl Jam. And this was like literally like elementary school, you know, barely understanding music. And then middle school progressed, and high school was like, you know, off to the races kind of thing. So because of the legacy, and because I found out about them so young, and the fact they're still going, and the fact that I still enjoy them and see them live, I think Pearl Jam takes the cake for me, because it was like finally something that like wasn't Led Zeppelin or the Beatles. It was like, no, it was happening in real time. And I was a kid, and I didn't really know I didn't even know what music was. It's like collecting comic books type thing, you know, like this is a cool thing that I really enjoy in a Walkman on a recorded tape off the radio, you know.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I got to relate that back to Pearl Jam, just being like, I think this is my band, and it still is today. And I'm, you know, 36 and still is my favorite band of all time. And so that legacy, it's tried and true. So I got to say, PJ, Pearl Jam.
That's a good mic drop question.
Yeah, you fucking love that band, right?
I really do, man.
CD wants to know, did we fucking love that band? I think we all did. So
yeah.
Yeah, great mic drop, Nate. That's a good one to finish with. Thanks, guys, for listening tonight. Whenever you listen to this, we really appreciate it. Hit us on the socials at Patio Slave on Twitter and Instagram, and then patioslavepodcast@gmail.com. We will do another mailbag down the road. So if you've got a question, we'll take it. Send it now. We'll save it. I have a little document compiling all of them, so we're ready to go to do that again down the road. So yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone. These are some of my favorite episodes, just because we outsource all the work. So thank you.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, for the fans, from the fans, just like us. So appreciate it, man. Cheers, everyone.
Thanks, all.
Peace, botheads.